This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The COVID-19 crisis has put a lot of people out of work. As of this morning, the number of state unemployment filings is nearly 500,000 with no signs of slowing down. WUNC Capital Bureau Chief Jeff DeBerry joins me now to talk about unemployment and the government's response. Welcome back, Jeff.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Jeff, I think we're hearing just a little bit of the feedback, so I'm not sure if I'm talking too loud in your ear, but we'll keep going and talk about this, and especially at North Carolina's unemployment rate now. How has it changed in the past month?
It has been an unprecedented and staggering change, and that's probably the best way to top line it. You mentioned accurately about 500,000 filings, new filings for unemployment insurance or unemployment benefits since mid-March. So not even a month. And that represents several years worth of new unemployment applications. To just give a snapshot of where things were a couple of months ago, the state unemployment rate was at about 3.9%, and they were receiving between 3,000 and 3,500 applications on average a week. Now, just for context, on Tuesday of this week, they received nearly 30,000. That was the second highest day that we've seen. And that's 10 weeks worth, typically, of unemployment applications in just one day. So it has been a huge number. I will note that the state has built up a trust fund, and it has started this pandemic with nearly $4 billion in the coffers to help with payments and disbursements to people who have been laid off. But that's a huge number, $4 billion, and it took them a long time to build up those reserves. But that's only going to last a matter of months with this number of people who have been affected.
Well, and the money is one thing, and it's good to know that some of that extra money is there that can be paid out at this time. But if you think about the load this puts on these state employees who are now working under very different working conditions, having to process this huge new number of applications under new rules. So, you know, sort of think about these state employees in this position of having to work from home in many cases, deluged with applications, and the rules have changed. Talk about that, how the state government has changed unemployment benefits since the start of the pandemic.
So out of the Great Recession, North Carolina rolled back some of its unemployment benefits. Just for example, the state now has a maximum weekly benefit of $350, and you can't be on the state unemployment rolls for more than 20 weeks. So those numbers are relatively low compared to a lot of other states. But what's also important to note about North Carolina is that there are some people, some workers who just are not eligible for state unemployment benefits. For example, sole proprietors, independent contractors, people who are self-employed. Now, at the same time, the unemployment infrastructure is really a hybrid of the federal and the state governments. So when the $2 trillion package passed a couple of weeks ago, part of the contents of that said, we, the federal government, are going to provide relief to gig workers and self-employed and independent contractors and some of the very people who North Carolina just doesn't cover. So to your point, you have these state employees who are doing, as we expect, best we can tell, their absolute very best to process these hundreds of thousands of claims. And now, plot twist, they're having to figure out how to verify and figure out how much money an Uber driver, for example, was making, or somebody who was self-employed was bringing in, so that they can check those folks out and connect them with federal benefits. And that's not been part of the state infrastructure. So it's layered and it's complicated. And when you have 500,000 people who are applying for this relief, it's been an overwhelming moment.
Well, and to give you a sense of what it might be like to apply and try to get into this system, we have a clip from a listener who tried to file for unemployment after being laid off from her job as a massage therapist. Let's take a listen.
March 21st, 22nd that I got laid off. I immediately, within like that day, started filing for unemployment because I had heard that the process was not super easy. So I applied and I checked the website and it just said ineligible. And it didn't really give an explanation as to why or anything like that. It said I had documents available in the documents folder. There was nothing there. Nothing explained why I was ineligible. So I was trying to figure out whether I needed to file an appeal or do something like that. And every time that I've tried to get a hold of somebody at the unemployment office, I mean, I know that they're slammed. I know that they are. But they've just been disconnecting calls automatically. Like I called yesterday and they said, well, it's essentially the message was there's too many calls and too much going on and we can't help you right now. And it disconnected. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but that was essentially what happened. And, you know, it's frustrating, but I know that I'm not the only one in this position.
That's Alyssa Emerson from Hillsboro sharing her story of trying to file for unemployment benefits in North Carolina after being laid off from her job. I'm talking about unemployment in the state with WUNC's Jeff DeBeery. So there it is. She's dealing with her own frustration and anxiety. She understands what state employees are going through and how difficult it must be for them and other people in her situation. How has the Department of Employment Security responded to this? What kind of adjustments are they making?
They're adding 350 employees. So I suppose that's a bit of irony here in this tremendous downswing of employment. This is a place that actually needs more people to handle all of these calls. So they're bringing in more people. They are contracting with a call center to try to bring up the ability that Employment Security Division has to handle more calls every day. And I will offer just one anecdotal note. I had a conversation yesterday with a woman named Allie Schoaf. She's a dental hygienist from Wilmington who was furloughed 3 weeks ago. And by virtue of some action that the governor has taken, people who have been furloughed or who have seen a reduction in hours are eligible to apply for unemployment benefits with the state. That had not previously been the case. So I spoke with this woman, Allie, yesterday. And when she shared with me, best of luck to anyone who wants to try this, but she said that she had waited until after 10 o'clock at night to use the website, and that in the three times she's been on the website, she has had good luck with getting results and getting her application through. And her thought was that the website just wasn't as bombarded late at night. Right.
Jeff DeBeery. Jeff, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Frank.
Jeff DeBeery is WUNC's Capital Bureau Chief. Well, as we've been saying, the coronavirus pandemic has sent financial and labor markets into a tailspin with historic unemployment numbers, lots of small businesses shut down. So what's the big picture and how is this crisis changing how our systems work and how they may work in the future? Diane Lim is an economist and director of outreach and senior advisor for the Penn Wharton Budget Model, and she blogs at economistmom.com. Welcome, Diane.
Thanks, Frank.
Steve McDonald is with us as well. He's a professor of sociology at North Carolina State University who focuses on labor markets and economic inequality. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Frank.
Diane, let me start with you and ask you how you would compare this moment to past economic crises.
Well, it's really quite different. You know, unlike a typical economic recession, which starts with some kind of dysfunction in a part of the economy, especially the financial sector, that ends up freezing up the entire economy kind of, you know, across the board. This is an economic recession. It will be a recession, I'm sure, that will have been driven by not underlying economic conditions and factors, but by this public health crisis. And so the way it is reducing economic activity is quite different from what we saw triggering the Great Recession. And I think it's also going to mean that the eventual recovery is going to look different as well.
Well, so what you're saying is that when typically in a recession or a depression, big pieces of the economy are actually broken, usually overvalued, and then these industries mm-hmm. collapse, and then people have to sort of pick through the rubble and say, well, what was that business really worth? Try to rebuild it from the ground up, and that's a time, a painstaking process. Here, everything mm-hmm. is fundamentally sound. People just can't get out and buy things. So what does that mean in terms of recovery and sort of how things might look different as you move forward?
Well, you know, I think that a big factor that's different right now is that the unemployed, and they are unemployed, are not as detached from work as is typical in a recession. So, you know, the people that have been laid off their jobs are primarily those people in the occupations and industries where it is impossible to socially distance yourself and carry on your work. So it's disproportionately slammed the leisure hospitality sector. It's now starting to bleed into retail sales like department stores, you know, and clothing stores. But, you know, a lot of these workers in the leisure and hospitality sector, at least, they are still connected to their employers, their previous employers. In fact, they would probably label themselves as still working for those employers, even though they're officially unemployed. And, you know, that's because the hope is that the businesses can stay afloat, that the workers, even though they're not working and earning wages, can hang in there in terms of being able to pay their own bills. And that means that everyone can kind of be ready to get back to business more as usual once the health crisis lifts for a bit.
Well, Steve, tell us more about that, the labor market, and again, how it's changed in past recessions and how you think how it looks this time around.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Diane that I think this is, and the word keeps getting mentioned, unprecedented. It really is unprecedented in terms of what we've ever seen in terms of the labor market. I think we have to really think about what this transitionary period is going to look like and what that's going to mean for the workforce. There's a lot of talk, like I think the president tweeted yesterday, about how we'll be open for business soon. And I'm concerned that, you know, when it's not going to be a moment where suddenly we're back to business, that we're going to have a very long transitionary period where workers are really going to be struggling to find employment and to kind of piece together ways to kind of survive. And I think, you know, there's probably going to be periods where, you know, there's going to be kind of ups and downs with regard to the economy. There's going to be geographic variability. But also I think the economy is going to change on the basis of this too. And there's going to be lots of destruction and creation across different types of industries and sectors. It's also changing the way that we work, how we're producing things, how we're distributing things, how we're consuming things. And I think that's going to have a big change on how it is that the workforce ends up trying to adapt to that and how organizations try to adapt to that.
Yeah, I'm going to talk more about that a little bit later on, too. I mean, I think that's a really important question, is how, what kind of adaptations we're making in this moment that might mean some very significant changes in our work lives moving forward. It's a good point. But, Steve, I want to ask you another question more immediately, and that is about those who are most affected and most vulnerable. And it does seem that immigrant workers are particularly vulnerable at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, we've had the CARES legislation that passed through Congress is going to do a lot of good for workers, but the immigrant labor force is not really part of that. And I think that's oftentimes something we don't really think much about. Is a substantial proportion of the workforce and contributes a lot to our economy. And, you know, this is a group of folks that are going to be very much affected. Obviously, other workers that are going to be affected by this, too, I think, you know, Diane was kind of alluding to this as well, in terms of, like, temporary, gig, part-time, contract-based labor. They're going to be in really precarious positions.
Well, we talked about what parts of the economy have been hit hardest, and I want to bring in one of our listeners now who owns a boarding kennel in Chapel Hill.
Well, I'm a business that's based on people being able to travel. And since people can't travel, it's been pretty devastating. I have reached out to Orange County, who is offering grants and loans at 0% interest to their small business people in the area, have attempted with the SBA situation, but they still have a lot of kinks to work out. I did create a GoFundMe page, which has managed to almost meet my goal, which is incredibly it's a very humbling experience because I've had friends and family and customers, new and old, help me stay afloat. So that has been a really, really cool experience.
Lynn Patterson is the owner of Noah's Ark Kennel and Cattery in Chapel Hill, talking about the economic impacts of the coronavirus now with economist Diane Lim and NC State sociology professor Steve McDonald. So Diane, Lynn was talking about setting up a GoFundMe. How typical and how vital are these? How essential are these fundraisers right now?
I think they're providing an incredibly important role. Private sector, ordinary communities of people coming together for the businesses that they've relied on in the past. And, so I think a lot of this is going on that customers that would normally have used the boarding kennel to when they took vacations, that those customers of Lynn's are going to want her to stay in business because they are going to hope that she eventually comes back online as soon as the health crisis, the stay at home orders are lifted and people start to be able to go out again. So I think that I've seen a lot of businesses reaching out to their customers, to their communities, and asking for help. And I think a lot of their customer base wants to support them. They want to get back to buying services from these businesses when we get back to normal. And so I think it's really, really important. And I think that that is a large reason why even the economic assistance that goes more broadly to people, even people who aren't literally laid off, right, the checks that have gone out, they can help the economy more broadly, because by keeping up people's income, cash flow, it allows them to, in their own terms, in their own ways, support the businesses that are especially hard hit.
Well, Steve, that gets in. Certainly, it's heartening to hear that people are willing to circle around those who, and they hope will, come back into business. But it does, I think, also point to what you were saying, is that those who are most vulnerable don't have the kinds of circles that they could even reach out to. And so I think that points, does it not, to the importance of some kinds of government programs? What do you think is the role of charity here, and does it reach down into those people who are most vulnerable?
Absolutely. I think charity is an important part of this. I mean, I think people are trying to adjust in lots of different ways. I mean, I think about this a lot, in part because I'm the director of our graduate program, our PhD program in sociology, and I think a lot about our graduate students and how it is that they're going to be able to respond to this. I mean, many of them over the summer, they try to take jobs, in restaurants and bars to kind of make ends meet or work as Uber drivers. And I've been receiving a lot of concerns, and people are very scared about what it is that they're going to do. And so, we've talked about putting together a Discord group so that you can share ideas about places that you could potentially work during this transitionary time. A lot of people are turning to their social networks in order to try to address these issues, right, and find any sort of help that they can to deal with these types of problems. And that does raise an issue about some vulnerable workers and the extent to which they're going to have the capacity or the ability to be able to persist throughout this difficult period. I know some of my previous work focuses on minority groups and the extent to which social networks can be really helpful for finding jobs, but they can also reproduce some of the inequities that we see in terms of employment opportunities. And then I guess to your other point, Frank, this issue about, it really does raise the importance of having a very strong social safety net. I certainly hope that this crisis creates an opportunity for us to expand things like, in terms of healthcare, in terms of housing, in terms of family leave, that would help to better protect the precarious elements of our workforce.
Talking about how COVID-19 is hitting the economy right now with Steve McDonald and Diane Lim. Steve is a professor of sociology at North Carolina State. Diane Lim is an economist and director of outreach and senior advisor for the Penn Wharton Budget Model. Also blogs at economistmom.com. Talk about the future of work and what changes this might bring economically, financially, and in the workplace. Diane, let's talk about the CARES Act. We're talking about $2.2 trillion aid package. Give us a sense of what that's meant to do. And I understand that it's early now, but have we seen any of the effects?
Well, what it's meant to do is not necessarily the stimulate is the word that we used to use for this kind of fiscal assistance package, like when we last implemented a big package in during the Great Recession. This package is much, much bigger than what we put into place during the Great Recession. It's also designed less to increase demand, because if you think about it, people can't really increase their demand for goods and services beyond where it was before the coronavirus crisis hit us. What we're trying to do is basically keep up people's essential consumption, allow people to who have lost jobs and lost income to maintain a certain level of essential consumption that includes being able to pay for their rent and their utilities and their food bills and their health bills, and allow them to kind of sit tight during this stay-at-home period. It is not really meant to literally get people back to work, which is we're constrained by the health situation, not constrained by what the economy can demand, right? So I would expect that it will have some beneficial effect, but people shouldn't expect that this kind of package, economic package, could reverse or eliminate increases in unemployment, since the increase in unemployment and the loss of GDP is totally dependent on what we're allowed to do.
In some ways,
from a health perspective.
Yeah, in some ways, it assumes that unemployment will continue. And since people aren't earning money, but landlords need to be paid, and perhaps restaurants, you know, you'd like to keep them in business because fundamentally they were sound, unlike other
right.
recessions. How do we keep money flowing through that system in order to keep everybody in their houses, landlords paid, taxes paid, not about getting people back to work? We understand that won't happen until we sound the all clear. So it's a fundamentally different kind of a problem and an interesting approach.
Right.
And it's costly as well. And I wonder how this works out. I mean, the Fed today announced new programs to provide up to $2.3 trillion in additional lending. So that means
right.
we're taking on more debt. In the mm-hmm. long run, you know, sort of what's the effect of this as we try to pay all this back? Or does it get paid
well,
back by keeping
honest,
things rolling?
To be honest, we can't really worry about that debt right now, because we really have no choice in order to keep the economy essentially on life support for the moment. You know, that's where the money is. That's where our funds are available, is the federal government has a lot of room to borrow more money. You know, I think that if we were not to put out that assistance, you know, it's very expensive assistance, but we would be worse off if we didn't put it out there and more parts of the economy truly died, right? So in the long term, this is the best thing for our economy, and therefore it will be the best thing that we could have done for the long term budget outlook as well, for the sustainability of the fiscal outlook.
Steve, go ahead.
Well, no, I just think that the most important thing we can do economically right now is to make sure that the money that the federal government is spending is going as directly as we can to the parts of the economy that need it the most.
Well, the parts of the economy and the people, too. Stephen, I wonder, you know, as you examine this, obviously this is something that gets put together fairly quickly, but are there shortfalls, other people, are there sectors being left out, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it points to, you know, we're talking a lot about, you know, the federal government spending and then loans that the federal government can take out, additional debt. I think one main concern that I have at this point is about actually the public sector, state and local governments in particular, which the Fed has really been very reluctant to expand its authority to provide greater loans and resources to state and local governments. And, you know, I think from in terms of the federal administration, too, I mean, obviously we've seen concerns about lack of support for local and state governments with regard to, like, PPEs and
I'm sorry, what are those? Forgive me. What were
those are the personal protective equipment for healthcare.
Oh, okay. I thought you were referring to a financial instrument. Go ahead.
No, but, you know, there's obviously concerns about the type of coordination or lack thereof. And I certainly am worried about that as well when it comes to finances. You know, many state governments have, you know, as part of their constitutions, they cannot deficit spend. And so there's a lot of pressure that's being put on the public sector, and I think that's going to filter down to public sector workers as well, who obviously, like in you know, when Jeff was talking about earlier, about some of the issues that we're being that the public sector workers are facing with regard to trying to process unemployment claims. We've seen you know issues with the sanitation workers in Raleigh, you know concerns about the working conditions now that they have to face. It's putting a lot of pressure on local and state governments, and there really needs to be, I think, a more concerted effort at trying to support them.
Well, let's take a look at the work life around the state. I'd like to bring in another listener now. This is Luis Carlos Serapio, the founder of Descubre Asheville, which is a bilingual website that focuses on the city's tourism industry.
Well, for me, creating content for the tourism industry here in Asheville, creating content that is bilingual, obviously, is making it really hard for my business to remain. However, I do want to believe that something good is going to come out of this. At the moment, I am not working. Most people are not working. I'm trying to do some community volunteer work in town. I feel like it's a good time to try to strengthen our relationships with our neighbors while being safe. So, the truth is, no, I'm not hopeless. I am very hopeful because of the community that I feel like I'm part of, the greater community, not only the Latino community. And I feel like we will get ahead. But exactly how that's going to be, I can't venture to visualize it. Really, I can't.
That's Luis Carlos Serapio, founder of Descubre Asheville. He's talking about what he's doing this time now that he's not working, and we're looking at the economic fallout of the coronavirus and how it might shape the future of work with NC State Professor Steve McDonald and economist Diane Lin. Diane, Luis obviously is hopeful. What's the outlook? I mean, business activity will come back. Wall Street is already beginning to rebound slightly and recover. But what's it going to look like for everybody? Will there be people left behind? Well, how do you envision, you know, the sort of the future of this coming out of this?
Yeah, so I think that some lines of work are innovating and kind of trying to pivot to and adapt to the circumstances, and they'll come out on the other side of this crisis actually more productive than they ever were because they've had to learn how to do things in efficient ways and in new ways. A lot of people are learning how to use technology a lot better now because we're forced to do that in order to stay connected with the rest of the world. I think that other industries, there are certain lines of work that may not do as well because it's impossible to, you know, people will have gotten used to doing things differently now and not going out to shop. And that may have lasting consequences even after the stay-at-home orders get lifted. So, for example, a lot of the retail sales industry, like department stores, you know, stores and clothing stores and shopping malls, their business was already on the decline for the past couple years. This could be the nail in the coffin for those kinds of businesses because you know, there's just not going to be a lot of appetite for going out to do shopping when you can very easily do it from home online. And I think that this is giving everyone practice on how to do things while at home. And so some of those businesses probably won't come back, or they'll have to think of new ways to draw customers to your brick and mortar shop. It can't just be to acquire things anymore. So I think that some businesses will be better off after this is over, and some may close down for good.
Steve, what about you in terms of looking at the workforce? What's that going to look like after this?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's, you know, in terms of organizations and in terms of workers, there's a lot of adaptive capacity that we have, right, in terms of innovating and finding out new ways of doing things. And I do think that that's going to change what the economy looks like and what work looks like. I mean, obviously, the big thing is that we're doing so much more virtual work, and that could be, you know, have some benefits. And it's also something that there are real serious challenges associated with. You know, how is it that we work as part of virtual teams? You know, how is it that we are able to cooperate together and collaborate, and even in cases where we don't have that sort of face-to-face contact? I think that's an important challenge. You see other types of innovations too, like with regard to using some virtual capacity. My wife is an actress in the Triangle area, and you know, one of the things we're starting to see is more and more theaters doing like live stream performances, you know, in order to deal with some of these types of things. In terms of consumption, it has a big impact on what how it is that we are involved in our consumption patterns. I think, you know, the other day I was talking with my wife about how, like, we may never go to the bank anymore now that we figured out how to scan our checks and send them in that way, right? So I think there's a lot of potential change that we'll end up seeing. Some are going to be, you know, good things, and others are going to have real serious challenges for.
Well, I wonder, too, because obviously adaptations in the way we work, but adaptations in the way we consume, and that might mean changes in production. You can imagine there's a lot of thought being put into how we can make things now without people being next to each other. That means more automation, more technology, and fewer people ultimately. So I guess that's one of the things that may come out of this, is that we need, I mean, this has been a process that's been in effect for a long time or underway for a long time. It seems like it'll be accelerated through this. Would you say, Steve, I'll stick with you for a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in a way we have to start, I think it would be good at least to start thinking about this as a potential new paradigm in the way that we're engaging in work, and rethink some of the types of policies that we have in place, in order to address work-based issues. I mean, a lot of the like social safety net provisions, you know, require that individuals are employed or looking for work, and you know, I think this is potentially a problem in an economy where we see more fluidity with regard to what employment, you know, stability might actually look like. The other thing is, I mean, health insurance being run directly through employers. This raises serious issues about, you know, whether or not in a new economy like this, that this is an effective way to run policies and to protect workers.
That's an interesting question, Diane. We've heard so many questions or so many critiques about government, the lack of support for a safety net, social infrastructure, and that sort of thing, and ultimately the cost and how many people it leaves vulnerable. And now in this pandemic, we've seen that the most vulnerable are the most at risk, hospitalized, and that's where a lot of our attention is going now. Will this allow us to rethink our social policies and say, to really prepare for the next pandemic, we need to make sure there aren't so many vulnerable populations and apply policies now, public policies, that leave fewer people so vulnerable?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that this experience is teaching everyone that sometimes there's no getting around a need for a strong a large role of government. You know, this is a public crisis that can only be addressed through very massive government intervention. And I think that I've already seen this among my economist colleagues. I feel like this experience has shifted everyone's ideology just a bit leftward from where they were before this started, because you know, government really, the federal government has to come in and fund all this stuff that we need. And the state and local governments are the ones that are basically implementing it. And really, no, we cannot rely on the private sector as much as everyone is rallying in support of each other and community. This requires government resources and government action and government coordination.
I want to thank you both for being on our program. Diane Lim is an economist and director of outreach and senior advisor for the Penn Wharton budget model, and she blogs at economistmom.com. Steve McDonald is a professor of sociology at North Carolina State University. He focuses on labor markets and economic inequality. Steve, Diane, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, Stacia Brown, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Josie Taras is our intern. Jenny Lawson is our technical director, and Al Widarski helped engineer the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.